Welcome to Roots Runners Rhizomes, Health and Healing from the Underground. I'm Sarah Faulkner. My comrade and usual co-host Lauren Jambroni is unable to join us today, but she'll be back on our next show, July 16th, to report back from the Allied Media Conference in Detroit, where she'll be working in the Healing Justice Clinic in tandem integration with radical nurse Emmett Phipps. And today we'll be talking with Ariana Reines. Ariana, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Just Hello? Barely. Oh, there. Okay, that's great. Hey, Ariana, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. So today we're going to be talking with Ariana about her experiences as a holistic practitioner with Haiti Citronica, a grassroots partnership between Western herbalism and a Haitian folk medicine that features a mobile naturopathy relief clinic. Ariana is also an acclaimed and innovative poet. Her recent book, Mercury, was published by our local Fence Books, whose editor, Rebecca Wolf, can also frequently be heard on WGXC. But before we talk with Ariana, I want to say a few words about Haiti. I obviously can't do the very complex history of Haiti justice in a whole show, let alone a few minutes. And I'm certainly no expert on Haiti either, but because so many of my fellow Americans express a near total lack of knowledge about Haiti, and because today we're going to be talking about aid and assistance to Haiti and some pretty complex things today, I just want to remind us of a few things about Haiti's early history and the ensuing dynamics still present today so that these factors are fresh in our minds. Apologies to those of you for whom this is not news. And Ariana, I hope if you have anything to add, we'll jump in right at the end. Let me just say a few things. So Haiti is the world's oldest black republic. The original inhabitants of the island were Taino Indians who did not survive long after 1492. That was the beginning of a series of European colonial occupations, enslavements, and exploitations. For nearly three centuries, countless African people were enslaved and brought to the island to labor on the world's most profitable plantations. And then in the 1790s, a coalition of slaves and free people of color fought and won a war of independence and proclaimed themselves a republic of nearly 500,000 people, which they named after the original Taino name for the island, Haiti. The battle for Haitian independence was a courageous, significant, an unprecedented victory for human rights and against slavery, racism, and colonialism. But to European powers as well as the USA, whose economies depended on racism and enslaving and occupying people all over the world, it was very threatening. So very unlike the similarly young Republic of the United States of America, in the early 19th century, not only did the new Haitian Republic not receive financial aid or support and solidarity or even recognition of sovereign status from other world nations, instead, Haiti's former occupier, France, demanded a ransom payment of 150 million gold francs, which it called retribution for the colonists' lost property of slaves, land, and equipment. And then France, Britain, and the United States colluded to impose a crippling embargo until Haiti agreed to pay. To pay, the Haitian government had to take out high interest loans from France and the United States. And that really laid the groundwork for a lot of Haiti's subsequent history. And by the way, that debt to France was not considered repaid in full until 1947. But of course, by then, Haiti had accrued other debts since its payment schedule didn't leave enough funds for basic needs and infrastructure. To give some actual figures, in 1900, Haiti spent 80% of its gross national product on debt payments. A more recent figure is from 2003, when Haiti spent almost $58 million just to service its debts. That's making just payments to foreign lenders. Since Haiti's founding, some commentators have described the last 200 years of Haiti's history as the presence of foreign troops alternating with dictators. And certainly internal conflict and inequity has been exploited to the advantage of outside interests. Since the 1970s, the Haitian elite has colluded with the so-called international community to impose a series of neoliberal economic policies and austerity measures, which have destroyed the domestic agricultural system and unfairly created markets for US food exports and sweatshop labor for US garment industry. Citizens and elected leaders' demonstrations of protest and rebellion against all these situations has in recent times frequently been put down violently with international assistance. And just recently in 2003, Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide even broached the topic of restitution and reparations, and then in 2004 was expelled from Haiti in a coup d'etat, which Aristide himself says was orchestrated by the Bush administration. So lastly, I just want to say that some experts have noted that even so-called international development efforts, foreign aid, and even charitable relief often ultimately function in the service of foreign exploitation and further disempowerment of the Haitian people. So that's just the tiniest bit of background for why I want to be sensitive talking about aid and assistance to Haiti, which is often a very loaded topic. And it also illustrates precisely why I'm delighted to be talking about this wonderful clinic that Ariana is involved with, which not only operates with partnership, respect, and solidarity specifically for the Haitian people, their culture, their autonomy, but it also seems a very fine clinic model for people everywhere to study and emulate in their own communities. So, Ariana, if you have anything more to add to that intro, please do. But otherwise, can you tell us about Haiti Citronica, how it came into being, and how you got involved?
Sure. And thank you for that wonderfully succinct, hard-hitting, accurate condensation of what has accumulated in Haiti and what is still being played out there. Haiti Citronica is really began as a personal effort on the part of the Venerable Septin Jinpa, who was born in Haiti, who had been in meditation retreat in France, so, you know, far away from any kind of technology or phone, internet, anything like that, when the earthquake happened on January 12th, 2010. And in fact, while he was in meditation, he had felt and had a dream and had something deeply unsettling that made him feel he needed to break the meditation anyway.
Wow.
And when he learned that his father's house had been damaged and that family was traumatized, but his brother was all right, he immediately began to organize the first clinic. He had been trained in homeopathy and naturopathy by Julia Graves, who is a well-known German-born herbalist. And so he had this knowledge, and he and Julia teamed up with a bone setter or midwife or docteur soi or plant doctor. There's sort of several names for what he does, named Oliama, who Jinpa had known his whole life. And they set up the first clinic, which I believe was in March of 2010,
mm-hmm.
and have basically held the clinic every 6 months since then. So in its initial phase, they were dealing with, I mean, really sort of the catastrophic earthquake damage, and doing a lot of dealing with fractures, setting bones. There was a child who had a skull fracture that when he arrived at the clinic in March 2010, and his brains were exposed, and a combination of Oliama's bone setting sort of abilities, he actually put his skull back in place, and the child was able to heal, and we saw him in the clinic this past May, and he's fine.
Wow.
There was a lot of very kind of immediately in the aftermath of the earthquake, as with other medical interventions, this one, which is on a very, very different model from the others, there was a lot of very miraculous kinds of healing happening. As was reported in the news, you know, there were lots of amputations without anesthesia, all kinds of just sort of desperate measures, but also kind of amazing rescues of people. And this clinic was a part of that, but it was done in a very personal way, which is to say, Junpa set the clinic up outside his father's house in the neighborhood where he'd grown up in Carrefour, which is right outside of Port-au-Prince and part of the capital, and was very, very heavily hit in the earthquake. And immediately, you know, what they began doing is healing neighbors and friends, people from the neighborhood. And then the clinic became mobile. They started going to different locations, spending a few days in each one, so that they could reach other needy people with something that was maybe more sustaining, and also more accessible to them, where there was more potential for them to have continuity of care than what people could get by lining up and trying to get some kind of free care, free medication from Doctors Without Borders or some of the other like Western medicine operations there. Yes. One of the things that the clinic is really, I don't know if I'm going on too long, but conscious of is, you know, plants that are indigenous to the Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean healing methods, ways of trying to marry those ways, which in many cases are forgotten. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, people's grandparents used to do things this way, but as people have left the countryside, thanks to NAFTA, and flocked to the cities in search of sweatshop work, there's a real disconnect from the land. Mm-hmm. And there's just been, in one and two generations, a great deal of forgetting about things that are available. And on the other side of it, there are also things that people are aware of and do practices that they do that the clinic has helped to sustain and foster. So a big part of what they were trying to do was also educate people about what they could do for free. I mean, leaves, moringa leaf, the moringa tree, which grows everywhere around the capital, is extremely nutrient rich, and it's great for people with malnutrition. You can cook it and eat it like spinach. You can make a tea with it. Mm-hmm. It's rich in minerals. It's full of vitamins, and it doesn't cost anything. So the clinic was really committed to also just providing education. It's just not even education. I mean, it's even more simple than that. Just when people were in such a shocked and traumatized state, often these are things that people knew.
Yes.
But somehow to have that sustaining, compassionate witnessing care that could help them see what resources were around them that were available to them that would cost them nothing.
Mm-hmm. And what they already knew.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And to support, enhance, sustain things that they already do was also such a tremendously healing gesture. And the beauty, so although there are many ways that the clinic could be wonderful, and in my fantasy, as something sustained, something that would continue, because there is such a rich, rich healing tradition in Haiti, and of course, you know, every place has its healing ways that are indigenous to it, but because Haiti has also always been a zone of such radical and violent encounter, it also has had this genius of absorbing many, many different modalities syncretically in the way that voodoo has done. Mm-hmm. And so there just seem to be really, really great potential both to support and sustain deeply Haitian ways of dealing with pathology, and also to bring an add to that with the Western healing tradition. And then this time we had an acupuncturist who's in the Chinese tradition, so that was part of the mix as well.
Is that Michelle Ledoux?
That's right.
Uh-huh. And yes. Let's back up a moment. First to when Jinpa came back to Haiti, how did he, did Oliyama, the bone setter, midwife, healer, did they already know each other or
yes,
they did?
They had known each other their whole lives. Mm-hmm. And I found that after meeting and talking with Oliyama, I started asking around, you know, to all my Haitian friends, and I found that many of them were delivered by midwives or Dr. Shui, like Oliyama, and that's across classes. That's not just, the lower and middle classes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kind of generalizations that get made about class in Haiti, but it's a very complicated, mm-hmm. fraught thing. So I did learn that... that people do use these midwives, and that it's perhaps a bit like in India. It's something that is inherited, is taught through the family line.
Right.
And in general, not every child who comes from a midwife or a doctor family will be taught the ways.
Right.
They have to sort of show talent for it and be called to it, and then they'll be given mm-hmm. given that knowledge.
So here we have Haitian-born Jinpa, who was in France, and in France is where he studied naturopathy. Is that correct? And where he made the contact with Julia Graves. Is that
that's right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So then he returns to Haiti with Julia Graves on that first clinic trip,
she
is
was.
That right?
Yeah. Yes.
And he connects with folks from his community where he grew up, begins this partnership. How long was the initial clinic and kind of what came out of that and gave birth to the next trip, which is the trip that you came to, is that right?
I think I was on my third trip, actually,
third trip?
Or mm-hmm. third or fourth. So I believe the clinic was about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
He just sort of made a commitment to come back around every 6 months as was possible and gather healers together. They collected, donated tinctures, dried herbs, flower essences, and homeopathics. Mm-hmm. And that's what the clinic tends to work with, because that's Jinpa's training and Yulia's tradition. And that way, you know, it's obviously not an emergency room, but we had enough donated supplies and medicines that we could give people a decent amount of whatever it was that they needed,
mm-hmm.
Which is to say, you know, not 6 months worth, but certainly enough. To sustain, non-emergency things, and mm-hmm. Also enough to alleviate
and in
a lot of more chronic.
You showed them how to make their own medicine, right? Too.
Yeah, in many cases. I mean, it's something that we learned. It depends on. You have to get a feel for people's circumstances
mm-hmm.
When they're coming in, and we're seeing. You know, we'd be seeing people of all ages and of different levels of precarity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole mix, and there's also, because Haiti also has a culture of aid,
mm-hmm.
Which has its really bad side. There would also be, you know, sometimes just people thinking they could get something for free, but I found that was extremely rare. I mean, really rare.
Mm-hmm.
Even at this late date, when the kind of emergency is passed and people are dealing with a lot more sort of chronic, ongoing problems, effects of malnutrition, contaminated water, lots of vaginal infection, lots of skin infections,
mm-hmm.
And also lots of psychical and psychological trauma. Basically, depending on who it was that we were seeing, I would always try to find out, does the person live in a tent? Do they live at home, how many people are in the household, you know, who's the responsible person in the household, things like that. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, absolutely, we, you know, we would show them how to disinfect water or, you know, talking to women about not douching, things like that, certain things that, yes, you know, depending on their circumstances, we would give what could be useful, what could be most useful to them. For example, in a school that we worked with in the hills near Kenskoff, a school that was built for really destitute, neglected children, but a school which is remarkably, almost dazzlingly well-appointed and well-managed. The school is like the only source of basic care that many, many of the students get. I mean, they're not bathed, they're not clothed, they're not fed. Mm-hmm. Many of them orphans, many of them de facto orphans. So when we were seeing those children, it was the teachers that we were, you know, giving their medicines to, and there was absolutely no point sending the child home with something that we knew that there wasn't really a home to speak of. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't want to get too repetitive.
It's all very succinct the way you've presented this. It's great. We're really getting a picture of how the clinic operates, what treatments that you guys have been providing. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about your fellow practitioners and maybe some of your most memorable experiences from your own work in the clinic. And
sure.
What you specifically do when you're there.
You know, I'm a real newcomer. Yulia trained me before going, but I'm not, and neither am I pretending to be a thoroughly trained naturopath in any way, shape, or form. I've always had a sense for it, a deep reverence for it, an attraction to it, and my own humble way of you know, using plants and herbs myself and with friends, but it was Yulia who asked me to work with the clinic. I haven't told that story, but it's a bit long and convoluted, but it was a happy accident. And so I will say I was the least experienced on the team, mm-hmm. by far. Michelle Ledoux is a very experienced and highly trained acupuncturist in the Chinese tradition. She's been in practice in New York almost 10 years. And she has her way of working with herbs and plants, but she's used to working in the Chinese tradition. So that's a lot of herbs that were not on the menu, so to speak. So Michelle had similar training to mine in that regard, and she also had very little experience with homeopathics, which in some ways are controversial. I would say I personally, my jury is still out on homeopathy. I'm not sure about it. but I loved working with tinctures, and I loved working with dried herbs. So Michelle, worked with the herbs and tinctures, and also gave acupuncture to people. Everything from people who had, you know, just sort of chronic pain, people with earthquake issues in different parts of their bodies, people who had been victims of violence of different kinds. Men and women, young and old, children, also people with trauma, with difficulty sleeping, with hypertension, which is very common. So she worked on people of all ages and sizes and conditions. And Oriyama also working with people with all different kinds of physical problems. In particular, also women with menstrual problems, women with problematic pregnancies, women who had, I mean, every sort of all the different women's health issues that can be had, mm-hmm. and also his way of bone setting, which I interviewed him about, because it's definitely, like, for Westerners who don't know what a bone setter is, I mean, you know, it's basically somebody who knows the skeletal system very well, uh-huh. and who, you know, if you have a fracture, something dislocated or whatever, will knock it back into place. And in some ways, it's a little bit also of a chiropractor. It's a little bit of a physical therapist. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit almost of a craniosacral mm-hmm. therapist in some ways, and with magical and religious aspect as well, mm-hmm. but the style is definitely harsh. I mean, it doesn't necessarily feel good to have Oyama reset your dislocated shoulder or fix your scoliosis mm-hmm. in one go. Mm-hmm. but that is the way of it. It's a kind of hardcore healing modality, and from talking to Jinpa, my sense was that, and also from talking to Oyama, my sense was that the sort of most miraculous and really extraordinary healing experience for him was working with earthquake fractures. Mm-hmm. He was really, really able to, you know, when people can't get a cast, get a splint, you know, go through that whole Western medicine rigmarole to heal a fracture, it's really kind of miraculous. I mean, it hurts for a moment, but mm-hmm. he was really, really able to heal many people for free, and in a way that, you know, when there was no possibility for them to return for ongoing care, to make it possible for them to somehow, you know, at least heal and keep on caring for themselves mm-hmm. In such a precarious situation. So that's Oyama. And then there was me. And my favorite cases, or the cases that most fascinated me, most attracted me, were situations where there was a kind of psychical or spiritual trauma that was manifesting mm-hmm. Physically. Mm-hmm. Those were the situations that I most relished working with.
As a poet, are you going to be investigating any of that material in your work? I'm curious.
I mean, inevitably, yes. I have been. I mean, I wrote torrentially when I was there, and I'm piecing through it now. There's actually an essay that I'm preparing for the Harriet Poetry Foundation blog about the work in Haiti. That it's not a poem, but it's very much nourished by a lot of the poems I was writing there. To give a quick story, there was a girl who came in with her grandmother and younger sister, the grandmother told me that she had hiccuping attacks for 4, sometimes even 6 hours at a time. Wow. Violent hiccuping attacks. And at first, the girl, whose name is Fabiola, was just, her aura was like huge with pain.
Oh my gosh, Ariana!
I think
we're out of time already.
Okay.
I think we'll have to do another interview where we hear the rest of this story. Very quickly, is there any website or anything where we'll post it on the Facebook page? But if you can say right now, if there's some place folks can look.
Absolutely, to learn more, and if you want to donate medicine or get involved in any way or donate money. It's haiti.citronica.com. I encourage you to get involved and support this wonderful and very personal local, familial, intimate, and extroverted in beautiful ways project.
Oh, we're off the air. Yeah. Okay, so...
Okay.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So thanks again, Ariana. And the next show is coming up, and we'll be back, Return to Our Homes, in 3 weeks.